You wait here. You do it.
Goes in your nose.
River is not asleep this time. We just finished watching Iron Man. What's your deal with Iron Man?
I have never been a fan of Iron Man. I never saw the movies, like his solo movies as a kid.
Mm-hmm. You're not a huge MCU person.
I'm not a huge MCU person, and I have been, like, morally against Iron Man, just, like, the whole, like, rich guy in a suit thing as, like, your superhero.
Sure.
Seemed really...
Do you like Batman?
I think he's fine. I like his stories. Okay. I like Adam West.
I see.
And
do you like Batman Returns?
Yes. Oh, yeah, that one's fun.
Okay. Yeah.
And I guess, like, compared to other superheroes like Spider-Man, who are, like, you know, your average person who's...
Your friendly neighborhood guy.
Yeah, who's, like, a person who's, you know, doing more than they can do because it's the right thing versus, like... You're a rich guy who just, his power is money.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, always seemed to me to be venerating the wrong person.
Right. And specifically with Iron Man 2008, your thing was what?
I mean, it's, weapons.
Oh, no. It's...
Oh, that Marvel had made a deal with.
No.
Well, I mean that was part of.
No, your thing was that you prided yourself.
Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. On never having seen it,
because it was this huge like cultural phenomenon. Everyone loves
the MCU, and it all started with Iron Man.
And very much like everyone loves Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark, except for me, and I don't like him.
Mm-hmm.
So I yeah.
Yeah, it's this generation's Star Wars, and you'd never seen it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the Avengers was, but whatever. Anyway, the MCU was this generation's Star Wars, and you'd never seen the first movie.
Right.
You'd never seen where it started, and you prided yourself on that.
Very much so.
Whereas Marvel's The Avengers was the movie that got me into movies, mm-hmm. or at least into Marvel movies, and the MCU movies. Sorry, I keep using Marvel, but really I mean MCU because you and your X-Men.
Love the X-Men.
Yeah. As previously established. Mm-hmm. I watched them all, honey. Mm-hmm. I watched them all with you.
Thank you, honey.
I mean, almost all of them.
All but the good ones.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
Anyway. She keeps... biting my finger, and I don't know where's her chew toy. Do we have one over here?
Not in the vicinity.
Okay. Anyway,
she's just
chomping. Flapping. Just chomping. I'm just gonna let her chew on that for a while.
Yeah.
Anyway, what was I saying? Life is hard with a puppy. It's been a rough week. Yeah. It's been an okay week, but it's been rough. I've done so much. I've done more laundry in the last week than I think I did in the year prior. Just so much pee on so many things. And no sleep. And I've been puked on in the night. Voluntarily.
Yeah.
I wanted her to puke on me so that she didn't puke on anything else that I needed to launder. Would need to launder. Anyway, what was I talking about? I was talking about Iron Man. Marvel's The Avengers got me into movies and then into MCU movies, and then Interstellar came around and then I was a goner. I was just into movies now. But yeah, after I saw The Avengers, my dad showed me Iron Man and Iron Man 2 and Thor and Captain America the First Avenger, because those are the ones leading up to The Avengers. And that, remember when you only had to watch 4 movies to be caught up on the MCU? Oh. Wow. It's been a long 15 years, almost 16 years, this franchise.
Ah.
It's old. Anyway.
And very productive.
Yeah. They're just turning them out. And for a while, their batting average was pretty good. Like, it wasn't like, you know... They were rarely hitting homers, but they were always getting a good double, you know? And so you got a cumulative, a lot of runs. Anyway, That's a weird baseball metaphor. Anyway, so yeah, I'd always like, you know, Iron Man. These were my movies. It took me a long time to start buying MCU movies on physical media, because while I really liked them by the time I started my collection in 2020, I had moved beyond them, you know? But eventually, I finally got, you know, the MCU movie that really spoke to me. Eternals! And then for... because why not? They were $4 at a used Blu-ray... at a used DVD store. I got the Blu-rays for Iron Man and Marvel's The Avengers. And tonight, we finally put on Iron Man. Because it was the only thing that you were in the mood to watch, apparently.
Yeah.
Was this movie that you'd always prided yourself on never having watched.
Yeah.
And you were mad when it ended a little bit.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I liked it. It works. It's a solid picture.
It's a solid picture.
Yeah, I had a couple...
It's still one of their best. It's, yeah, okay, talk about your problems.
Yeah, so as I was watching it, I had a couple problems that I kind of, like, was like, okay, I'll stick a pin in this and think about it later. And it ended up kind of, like, resolving both of my issues with it as it was going.
Mm-hmm. Which is, what are they?
The first one, it still is kind of... I don't know. It resolved it to a certain degree within itself, but it still, I don't know.
What is the issue?
Okay. Well, the first one was that, so he's got this whole arc of, like, realizing that weapons are bad, mm-hmm. and that the military and all that is causing harm, and that what he's doing is hurting people and he should not be selling weapons. And so he has this whole arc of coming around and caring about people and the world, and which involves him being in a, you know, a situation where his weapons are used on him.
Mm-hmm.
Which I like, always like to think of in, like, connection to, like, Logan's run of the how everything changes when it's you.
Sure.
Idea.
Yeah.
Love
River,
that he
chill.
Has to undergo that transformation.
Mm-hmm.
Great. What I didn't like was that his issue with the weapons and the war isn't that, oh my god, people are getting hurt, but, you know, war is bad. I also am getting hurt. Look at all these people who are being hurt by my weapons.
Yeah.
That's not his issue. His issue isn't that American weapons that he made are hurting foreign people. His issue is that foreign people then get those weapons and hurt American people with his weapons. And yeah. So his issue isn't these American weapons are hurting people. It's, oh wait, you can't do that. I'm supposed to hurt you. We're supposed to be hurting you. You can't hurt us the same way we were going to hurt you.
His initial motivation, you're right.
And that just, it was kind of like, wow, you almost got it, but that's still kind of not the best.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, on the one hand, it would be a good motivator for getting the message out to American people to say, hey, your soldiers are going to be hurt by this, but it's not the best
sure.
for him
and
to
that's,
be.
And that's his initial motivation. And mm-hmm. then what happens is, well, first of all, the hero of this movie... And the hero, by extension of the entire MCU, is a man called Yinsen. Mm. Is a surgeon and scientist who saves Tony Stark's life and sacrifices himself to help him escape from the cave. Yeah, and so then and he's from this town, this fictional town in Afghanistan, and then when he hears that the weapons are being used against those people, he's like, wait, the government's not even using the weapons I gave them to do the right thing, so I guess I'll do the right thing. This is a very American movie that... is trying to say the right thing and doesn't quite. because ultimately it says what we need is a private military. Right. Thus, the MCU happens.
Yeah.
The Avengers are a private military. And, yeah. And then in Captain America Civil War, the debate comes as like, maybe they shouldn't be a private military that can do whatever they want. Maybe that's bad. And Captain America is like, no, we do need to do whatever we think is right. Anyway, it's just the whole thing. When you have a franchise based in violence, it's going to say some very dark and problematic things.
Yeah.
That said, I do like this guy's arc in specific. Once you get past Iron Man 3, Tony Stark's arc, I think, is kind of out the window.
Mm.
But initially, he was only contracted for a few films. And they only had him as far as Iron Man 3. And so they figured that by the end of Iron Man 3, this guy is either going to be the most expensive actor on the planet, or we're not going to be able to get him again. Mm. They ended up paying him $50 million a movie.
Mm. Wow.
And he became the most paid actor on the planet. Mm. But there was a chance that he was not going to be in any more movies. And so from Iron Man 1 to Iron Man 3, we get a solid arc in his character with a beginning and, most importantly, an ending. Mm. And so I'm interested to see, because you haven't seen Iron Man 2 or Iron Man 3.
No.
So you don't know where that arc ends. And then he's just back for Avengers Age of Ultron. And we get a scene in Captain America Civil War explaining why he's back. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. What I'm trying to say is this movie starts a solid arc.
Yeah.
But it also starts, you know, I want to be a private military, and that's a problem. That said, it's a really good, entertaining movie, and I like it a lot, especially when you look at everything that came after, because it feels like a real movie mm-hmm. made by real people, and there are real props and real scenes taking place in real locations, like... That's actual sunlight on Tony Stark's face. Mm. That is an actual, like, they actually went somewhere and filmed. They didn't just go to the green screen. Mm. It looks magnificent. The CGI in this movie looks better than the CGI in any of the movies that have come out in the last 5 years. Mm. Like, it just does. It looks like it belongs in this world. That suit looks real. I was surprised years later when I found out that that wasn't a real suit. Mm. Because, surprise, they mixed the real suit with the CGI suit all the time, like they do in a movie like Jurassic Park, where they're not just relying on the CGI. Anyway.
Yeah, no, you're right.
It feels like a real movie. And I'm pretty sure it's shot on film, because it looks good. It's still got some... It's still a 2000s movie, so it has my least favorite aesthetic in a lot of scenes, but it looks like a real movie instead of just a digital vomit on the screen. There are ways to make digital vomit look good. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 looks good. It's digital vomit, but it looks fun. Anyway, I'll let you talk now. You think this is a good movie too?
Yeah.
It's funny. Do you like Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, he's fine. I don't get like the hype around Robert Downey Jr., but he's fine.
Sure. I think he's charming.
Yeah, I know, he's charming.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you breaking news. We watched Iron Man 2 and it sucks.
It is very bad.
It's not good.
It introduces like the
a half dozen interesting ideas.
And like specifically the one that it starts off with that I think I was like, "Oh, it's going to go with this," which is an interesting idea, is that so he solves world peace. He stops war, and then becomes this like independent party that has like done all these.
No government has. It's like the anti-United Nations.
Yeah,
it's almost like anarchist.
Yeah,
anarcho-capitalism? ?
Yeah, and so the government is saying, "Hey,
we want it.
Who are you to?" To have all of this power, let's talk about that, because And, like, not only, like, him, but, like, the other people who are going to copy this technology. And so, like, that is, like, an interesting issue to, like, talk about. Mm-hmm. And then they ignore it for the rest of the movie and then end up concluding that Iron Man is cool.
Yes. They also have, what if, so you've solved world peace. Then this other guy comes along who has the same technology of, same technology as you. In fact, maybe you are taking his technology. Like, your dad took his dad's technology. That is explained away in a line. But anyway, again, it's thrown away.
Yeah.
No, he bad, Iron Man good. And you have,
we like him. He's our boy.
Yeah, you have the character of Justin Hammer, who's like, okay, you are no longer running the show of the military-industrial complex, but the military-industrial complex is still a thing, and here's Justin Hammer, who is now going to fill that gap, and now you have to deal with him. That's an interesting idea.
Oh, yeah.
You have the interesting idea of the relationship between Pepper Potts and Tony Stark, this very, very, like, two doms, you know?
I do enjoy them, like, talking over each other.
Yeah, and it's like, and now she's running the company, and that relationship is changing. There's so many little ideas.
Which you also revoke at the end.
You also have, and then, yeah, exactly. And then
she can't be a CEO for two movies.
And then you have a Black Widow showing up, and would you please exit the donut? You have, like, all this little S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff going on as well. And you also have Tony Stark is dying? And, like, there's so many different things that, if you focused, could be good. And instead, you throw them all in one movie, and it's very bad. Yeah. It's quite incompetent in how it lacks any follow-through and literally ends with a penis-measuring contest with the size of Iron Man and War Machine's guns.
And then they like, tie it up in a little bow on the rooftop and are like, and that's the end of the movie. And I'm like, but
there is no, it's very bad.
It
lacks the focus that is in Iron Man 1.
It not only do I think,
which is your point, I'll say, I'm quoting you.
Yeah, because the first one feels really focused. It feels tight. This one feels just like there is everything somewhere in there,
and none of it really comes to the surface.
Yeah, it feels like it's not a well-made story in the sense that it just feels like a mess. And then also, like, the moral conclusion I also don't agree with.
No, so, yeah, like, the moral conclusion is terrible.
It's just nothing is good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's just, when you have a movie that opens with a Senate hearing, I'm like, oh, yeah, Oppenheimer. Like, yeah. Like, I'm waiting for something explicitly political and actively having these conversations, and it just sidelines them, and it all leads to a joke at the end where Gary Shandling pins a medal on a guy. And that's what it was ultimately about. No, it wasn't. It was about questions.
And, like, Oppenheimer is, like, a fair comparison in the sense of, like, guy who has
developing
realizes
weapons and maybe needs to realize the consequences of that. Yeah. No, yeah. Oppenheimer is a much better movie than Iron Man 2. I think that might be a hot take, but I'm going to stand by it. Did you had more points about Iron Man 1, though.
Yeah. I guess, like, the main one that I didn't talk about was that, like, the literal idea of Iron Man doesn't work for me. Like, the literal idea of guy realizes that war profiteering is bad, so he, a rich guy, uses all of his funds to make a super suit so he can fly around. Like that direction. I was like, okay, because, like, he could donate to charity. He could help doctors. He could, you know, do all of these things.
Sure, and he's going to get to that. But first, right. he needs to fly.
Right. He could, all of those funds that would take to make a super suit that flies with all of that cool tech, you know, that just gets junked every couple minutes.
Or he could just go straight into working on the arc reactor.
Right.
That was the main thing that he get. The suit was just a get out of jail free card. The arc reactor is the breakthrough.
Yeah, and because those are things that wouldn't be, like, used to,
it's the energy revolution that gets, again, like, a paragraph of dialogue in Iron Man 2.
Yeah, and
And those things also couldn't be misused as easily as like a weapon.
It's just free energy.
Yeah.
Essentially.
And because like part of the comment of like the first one is if you make weapons, others will use them and then we will all have weapons and be shooting each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of this guy just making a suit is not only like narcissistic, but also like
you have the newest, you have the next steam engine. You have like, what do they say? It makes the nuclear generator look like a AAA battery or something. Like you nuclear power plant look like a AAA battery. Like you have the potential, and he goes into I want to fly.
Yeah, and yeah, and so my thought was like that literal.
And even if you what if that was his thing, and then he was confronted with, hey, these weapons are still out there. And that's when he decides to build the suit.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, wait a minute.
It's not his first thought.
Yeah, it's not his first thought. His first thought is, hey, this arc reactor, it's powering me or whatever. And by the way, what's up with his heart?
Yeah.
Like, so is originally, it was just a magnet, right?
Mm.
Hooked up to a car battery.
Mm.
And it was keeping the shrapnel from entering his heart.
Mm.
And killing him. And then So then he got an arc reactor, a little tiny one that he could just put in there, so that could power the electromagnet itself, so he didn't have to walk around with a car battery. And while it's at it, it could also power a suit and stuff.
Mm.
How is it keeping him alive? That's my question.
And because, like, how does the illness that we see in the second one connect to the first one?
Well, I mean, that is like the palladium that he's putting in. That's poisoning him.
Right.
I guess. But how is it like he takes it out and he's immediately dying? Wouldn't it just mean that it's not powering his heart? It's just keeping shrapnel away from it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's a weird plot hole. I'm sure if I Google it, someone's answered it.
Mm.
But anyway, just refrigerator thoughts about Iron Man. What's up?
Oh.
You have more thoughts?
Yeah. I just finish my thought.
No, please go ahead. Sorry. I keep doing this.
Yeah, it's cool. So, like, my initial thought was that to take it literally doesn't work for me. And then I was like, well, if you were make it a metaphor and have there be like metaphor.
Take what literally? Sorry, what?
The idea of a suit, the super suit.
Yes, okay.
If you have him literally making a metal super suit, that's weird. But we're in comic book universe and comic book metaphors, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And so if we have it be...
What's this analogous to?
If we take this suit for like a symbol of his own self-actualization and strength and like, like using...
His powers for good.
His powers for good. Then it coheres.
Sure.
But if you take it literally, it doesn't work.
Yeah. His suit for him is like, I need to build this so that I can stop my tech. I am taking the tech back into my own hands, essentially. It is now literally me. It is my body.
Yeah.
It is an extension. It's his prosthesis, as he says in the second one.
And it's something that he's going to focus on. It's not something he's going to sell and then forget about. He has to think about it constantly.
Yeah. And I can't wait to watch the third one, because then we show what happens when you've got post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm saying too much. When you get post-traumatic stress disorder and you can't stop obsessing over your skin.
Okay.
But the suit is the skin.
Mm.
Anyway, I'm excited.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Do we want to talk about Star Wars and Poirot?
Sure.
Oh, let's do this. So in Iron Man 2, who plays the main bad guy?
Mickey Rourke?
Yes.
Yes.
Mickey Rourke.
Mm.
Mickey Rourke is also a star.
Mm.
In the 1983 Francis Ford Coppola film Rumblefish, which I introduced to you. Was that only last night?
Yeah.
Wow, we watch a lot of movies really quickly.
Yeah.
Which is one of... I always say one of my favorite films. It's like it's pretty great. For me, it's one of my favorite films. Mm-hmm. I keep saying... I have a lot of them. It is a great movie. It's pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite Coppola joint. Stars Matt Dillon, Diane Lane, Mickey Rourke, as well as a entire huge slew of other actors. Dennis Hopper, Lawrence Fishburne, Tom Waits, Nicolas Cage.
With his hair.
Yes. Huge slew of character actors. Anyway. And it's black and white. It was made as a companion piece to The Outsiders. And where The Outsiders is Technicolor. You've seen The Outsiders.
Oh, yeah.
It's on our wall. Not the best version. The complete novel is the best version. Anyway. Black and white. Very expressionist cinematography. To the point where they're literally painting shadows on walls. An incredibly atmospheric sound design. The sound design in this is wild. Every scene is either too quiet or too loud. I love this movie. I love its portrayal of frustrated youth and the sense of being trapped in an environment that breeds nothing but violence and self-destruction, and how the Rusty James as the character that needs to flee to survive or else he's going to become like his brother. A hero who is a depressed sad sack. I adore this film. I adore it. It's a very important movie to me. And you hated it.
I did not hate it.
I know you didn't hate it. But when it ended, and I was like, what did you think? And you were like, I was like, oh no. You did not like, you were not a huge fan of the film when it ended.
Yeah, I should, a disclaimer, I was not having, I was not in the best mood last night.
Fair.
And so.
But if it was a great movie, it could have fixed that.
Right.
Maybe. Sometimes it does. Movies can do that. Sometimes not. But.
So, like, I might rewatch this and be like, oh, what was I thinking?
Sure.
But
on first viewing, you were very distracted by how straight the movie was, right?
Well, I don't know. I guess I.
That's what you said when the movie ended.
That's true.
I want you to just explain.
Let me lead up to that.
Yeah, okay.
Because, so, it's a beautiful movie. The look of it is beautiful. The shadows are gorgeous.
The use of time-lapse photography.
It's so good. And so this was a film that I could look at and say, wow, this is a really technically good film. I see why you like it. I see that, like, I can cognitively see the quality of this film. But I felt no emotional connection to the characters. And was not emotionally invested until, like, the very end of the movie. And at that point, I was just kind of like, oh, I get it. Oh. Yep, I see. This pulls it together for me. And I was like, okay, I can see why this is, like, a good movie. But no emotional, like, I don't know, no emotional resonance for me, at least. And so it felt, especially because I wasn't really a fan of Rusty as a character.
I don't think you're supposed to be. But.
Well, and I wasn't really a fan of many other people, and they don't really show much of the rest of the characters. Like, they show a lot of characters, but they don't show much of them.
No one has an arc but Rusty.
And I didn't, you know.
And, yeah. You like Steve, don't you? The nerd?
I mean, I didn't really see much of him to. I don't know. I guess a lot of the characters felt kind of distant to me. Like, what I saw of them didn't really.
You didn't like Cherry? I mean, Diane Lane's character? She plays Cherry in The Outsiders.
To be honest, I thought there wasn't. I don't know. At least to my mind, there wasn't.
Much there?
Much there. It was like, ah, yes, this is the girlfriend character who was right to call him when he. Treats her poor, call him on it when he treats her poorly.
He does treat her very poorly.
And she calls him on it, and she's there for him to have that experience. Not, she doesn't have her own arc.
But there's so much smoke in that one scene. Isn't it good, the smoke and the fog?
I love the smoke, but I don't
And it's about how they're in war. They're right there in Vietnam, but it's their childhood. And it's, oh, it's so...
I guess because, like, I already wasn't connecting with the characters. I was kind of being like, okay, here are a bunch of straight men doing stupid...
Making poor decisions.
Yeah, doing stupid things. And so that, like, kind
of... The way that time is so out of joint in this movie, that clocks don't have hands or run too fast, or the way that the clouds don't line up and they're moving too fast. What's going on? What is this world? What time is it? What year is it? It's all so interesting. But no.
Yeah.
You're like, it's straight.
Well, but the reason that the straightness, I guess, stuck out to me was because I didn't connect to the characters much.
Sure, yeah.
And so it was like another layer of like otherness was like
distancing.
Oh, and these are a bunch of straight people who are doing typical straight people things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I liked it. I don't know. I liked the ending, and I think like one reason I liked the ending was because so that we have the laser disc of this, and it has the tagline.
I love the poster. Mm. It's a beautiful poster. It's my favorite of our laser discs for its art.
Mm.
Anyway, but it has the tagline. Rusty James can't live up to his brother's reputation. His brother can't live it down.
And so
Motorcycle Boy, and that's all he's called in the movie, is the Motorcycle Boy.
Yeah. And I've seen that poster over and over again, and so I'm very familiar with the tagline. And then I watched the movie, and I went through a lot of it, and I was like, yep, this is the tagline. And I didn't get, like, too much more, like, elaboration.
It never goes beyond the tagline.
And so when it gets to the end, and the motorcycle boy is trying to get the fish out to the river.
The rumblefish.
I was like, okay, not only does this tie the story together, you know, by, like, using the fish to, you know, as a metaphor for the people, but also, like, this is a person who has a specific desire, and that is to free fish, and that isn't on, like, the list of, like, I don't know, things I expect the characters to do. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, this is a specific, sure, unique, like, desire. Concept. That is character-specific in a way that I was like, okay, I like this more, but... Yeah, that was a first viewing. I think after hearing you talk about it, I probably would like a
and the
second
essay,
viewing more.
The essay. And like, and yeah, no, and the thing is that it talk about how straight these guys are, and yes, they are straight, but also Rusty James and the Motorcycle Boy, like the essay says, are not your typical machismo, you know? If you're looking for machismo, you look for at Lawrence Fishburne or Nicolas Cage or that other guy. I can't remember his name. Like, those are the tough guys. Right. You know, Motorcycle Boy is quiet and slight and regretful and thoughtful. And he's a bookworm as much as Steve is. He just doesn't talk about it with Rusty James. And Rusty James... is just kind of a pathetic little baby. Like, neither of these are people we're supposed to be idolizing.
No.
And the problem is that Rusty James thinks he needs to be... is idolizing the person who his brother was and is the person that neither of them should be.
Yeah, I like that.
And so I like how this film is a deconstruction of masculinity. And on top of... Yeah, anyway. So it's not just that Matt Dillon is one of the sexiest people to ever walk the earth. It's not just that. It's a good movie, too.
Right. Anyway. And see, like, I don't even have that to...
Like
to interest me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Diane Lane. No. This is a welcome film for bisexuals. You know, Matt Dillon, Diane Lane. Mm. They're there. Anyway.
Yeah. No. I'm glad you like it. I hope to like it on a later or I should say, I hope to like it more in a later viewing.
Speaking of, I'm glad you like it, Nimona.
Yeah.
So I had seen Nimona, and I knew that you would love Nimona, and so you put Nimona on while I was organizing footage. And you really like Nimona. Tell me about Nimona.
Yeah, I thought it was really fun. I don't know. I don't watch too many kids movies, I guess. Yeah, and it does have a lot of like your like kind of kids movie beats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think as you said, it's kind of has, you know, predictable quality.
Sure.
In
terms of the overall narrative arc.
Yeah, and I feel like I kind of got that, but in the sense of, like, for me, it wasn't like, oh, this is going to happen. It was like, yeah, that's going to happen, but, like, I'm enjoying this movie, so, yeah. Like,
no, I was never not enjoying the movie. No, well, let me be clear. I was never not enjoying the movie. It's just that the movie never surprised me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Narratively.
I really like the characters. I think the world is a very pleasant place to be in.
The animation is not displeasing.
I like the queer narrative.
Yeah,
that hits for me.
The and we're not just talking about like the gay romance at the center. I mean, though, that is cool.
Yeah.
Ambrosius Kazuntite and
Golden Loin
and Riz Ahmed Ballister.
Yeah.
Bal.
Yeah.
Is his pet name. But the character of Nimona is a shapeshifter. Cough cough is genderqueer, cough cough.
Mm.
Like, are you a girl? Are you a boy? I'm Nimona. I'm a shark. I'm a shark right now. I'm like, you're a little boy now? I am today. Like, it's the language in here is the perfect, it's like word for word how a genderqueer person responds to a small-minded person. In that they use terms like small-minded,
yeah.
You know, in talking about the people asking them all the questions.
Yeah, and it feels very much like a movie where, like, if it, like, I don't know, straight parents can if they try, can really be like, oh, well, they didn't use the word genderqueer, but then anyone else will be like, no, like, clearly, the person just... like just responded to the question like are you a girl?
It's by a non-binary writer. It's by a trans mass non-binary writer. Good luck saying it's subtext.
Yeah. It is the text.
Yeah. I think it's a really good film about othering of peoples and how that slips into fascism. It all comes back to fascism.
And I really like, I don't know, it feels like a very bright movie. Like, I guess that's the adjective I'd use in terms of, like, how this movie feels, which is just so nice, like, to have. It feels like, I don't know, like, almost dependable in that sense. Like, I'm scrolling through movies of, like, that I've watched recently or want to watch, and I'm like, yep, Nimona, that's a solid, will make me feel good movie. Yeah, and I like having, you know, a solid entry of like queer cartoon.
Yeah. No, it's yeah. It's, I don't know if it's revolutionary, but we now have a movie that we can show kids instead of Cinderella. You know? Like, it's just like it's a baseline fairy tale movie that is so much smarter. And that it's inoffensive and light and fun, and it doesn't, like, it's baseline, here's how to tell a story, this kind of story, and yet it also has that added layer of our protagonists are queer, if not genderqueer, and it's about class and gender and fascism in there. That's in there too. And you really can't say that it's not.
Yeah. And I love having like such a good baseline, and I like having that fantasy for queer people. You know, that there's so much of like fantasy that's not queer, and it's nice to be included in that world.
Yeah.
Pretty much explicitly included in that world.
Pretty cool. Speaking of high fantasy science fiction fascism.
Mm-hmm.
Now do we want to get to Star Wars?
Yes.
Okay. We finished Andor.
Mm.
And Andor's fantastic.
Yeah.
That second half is, it just keeps getting better and better.
Yep.
The prison arc is so amazing.
You told me it would get better, and I was like, yeah, well, this is pretty great. And then I was like, oh no, yeah, you're right. It does just get better.
There is one way out.
Mm.
Oh, Andy Serkis as Kino Loy is amazing.
Mm.
Everything in the prison is so good. And then the funeral at the end is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like trying not to bawl talking about it, let alone watching it. Like,
I will say, like, those shots at the end of the, you know, Imperial people with shields looking like modern day police officers.
Yeah.
Beating back.
This is obviously citizens. Intentional.
Very topical, very, very current.
Imagine being Marva, and after you die, I mean, you wouldn't know because you're dead, but you're dead and your gravestone, your literal stone that you are in, and using that to beat a fascist cop to death.
Love that.
What a way to go.
Hmm.
Like, yeah. We've been sleeping. We think we could just, like, it's a very challenging last statement, because, like, she thought that she could always have her community, you know? We queer people think we can, at least we have our community, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, we're going to be in Le Grand for a long time, and we're going to be like, at least we have our community. No, you still got to fight the fascists.
Yeah.
Because eventually they're going to come, and they're not going to want to leave. Like, no, we're Idaho now. Like, it's... Maybe it won't go that way, but things are looking like it might go that way.
I love that this series' conclusion is kind of like, you can't just pretend this doesn't exist. There isn't an in-between to a certain extent, you know?
There's no neutral ground.
Because when you are being oppressed by the Empire, you don't just get to say, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, you...
If you ignore it, people will die.
You have to... You always have to fight fascism.
You have to fight it. This series is a call to action.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a great one. It is the best Star Wars because it actually understands what war means.
Yes.
Like, what is it the rebels, like one of the rebel factions, because it's not an alliance yet, it's just a bunch of factions, a bunch of people on the left who can't agree with each other, and so the Empire is encroaching ever further. And like, hey, we're going to lose one of our factions, but we have to do it if we're going to survive. And it's like, what do we call it? The greater good? We call it war. This is what war is. It's horrible.
Yeah.
We're going to burn our soul for a sunrise we know we'll never live to see. Mm. Like, the dialogue in this show is so good. It's so fantastic. Every line is so amazing.
Yeah.
Like, not to just gush.
No, it this one hits.
Yeah, I... It's a truly beautiful work of fiction.
Mm.
It is what science fiction is for, is to tell stories like this.
Yeah. And
And this is the one that shows us why we're fighting the Empire. Because I feel like the original trilogy and a lot of the other ones that I've seen, at least,
mm-hmm.
feel very like, why are we fighting it? Well, because they're bad.
Because they're bad and we're good.
Because, look, they have red lightsabers. And we have green. And there's a place for that, but...
There is a place for that, and we'll get there soon.
But it doesn't show me what I'm fighting.
Yeah.
You know?
Why fight? Why the violence?
What are they doing?
Because the violence is already here.
Yeah.
No, it's... Yeah. As a pacifist, it's weird to love this show mm. that says you must fight.
And I mean, for our world, I guess fighting doesn't always have to be hitting someone with a brick.
Or blowing up a garrison or something, but...
But you gotta fight. You gotta be on...
There is one way out, and it's resist.
And it's for everyone.
Everyone has to do it. Everyone has to do it. If you don't, then it will fail.
It's the importance of getting Andy Serkis on our side. It's to get everyone... So that, like that moment where he realizes he is not gonna be the lucky one to get out, and he realizes that...
Yeah.
That he has to be on the same team as everyone else.
Yeah, we're either going to die giving them what they want, yeah. or we're going to die not giving them what they want.
Yeah.
And if they get what they want, they build a Death Star.
Yeah. I like showing who's doing the work behind that Death Star. Who's doing the work that is making this empire possible. And it's,
And then you have, like, the stuff with, like, Dedra Miro and what is it? Is it Sylvian? Or Silas? The incel.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
We have Dedra Miro, who is a woman, a lone woman in a workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And so we root for her,
mm-hmm.
you know? For her to get over the guy who's like looking and talking down to her, and we feel good for her when the superior starts to take a shine to her.
It's that like Onion headline, like the Onion headline about how like there's one about like how there's a like a isn't it great to have a woman dictator or something, and like it's a step forward that we can be oppressed by a woman.
Yeah. And then we realize that Dedra Miro is absolutely an awful human being who is doing awful things to people.
Mm.
And yeah, and then we have the incel who is so obsessed with being a hero when really he's just a cog in a machine.
Mm.
Anyway, this is the best Star Wars.
Yeah. It's
the best Star Wars.
Yeah.
Which Nancy disagrees with.
And I am very hesitant about.
You're hesitant.
Because I love Empire.
Yeah. So, I mean, we might as well get to it. We watched the original trilogy on VHS, mm-hmm. the box set.
So good.
With your mom.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time that I've seen those movies, the original trilogy, since I was like 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm.
I'd seen... episodes 1, 2, 4, 5, 6 when I was a kid. Once. I'd rented them from the library, and 10 minutes into Revenge of the Sith, the DVD stopped working, and so I never finished it.
Hmm.
So I remembered liking 4, 5, 6 and 1, 2.
Mm-hmm.
It was before I had taste.
Mm-hmm.
So I just liked them. So, yes, Star Wars 1977 is a scrappy little movie that holds absolutely none of the moral weight of Andor. So it was weird following Andor up with it.
Yeah, and I feel like I need to change my criteria for this movie, because, like...
How do you mean?
Like, I feel like I'm judging, I don't know... My appreciation for Andor is on a different set of criteria than Star Wars, in the sense that Andor is like, this is, you know, comment on fascism, mm-hmm. and all of this politics and all of this comment, whereas I feel like my criteria for Star Wars is more like, this is, you know, a movie that, like, I don't know, is emotionally resonant in these ways and has mm-hmm. these performances that I love and has this tactile sets and costumes. And
which Andor does too.
Well, yeah, but
I know what you mean. I know what you
nothing,
mean.
Nothing looks quite like, no, at least nothing, to my eye, nothing looks quite like Star Wars, the original.
Yeah, Star Wars 1977 is...
unaltered.
It's, you know. Yeah, in its original form, which, yeah, I'm never going to watch the special editions if I don't have to.
Yeah, why would you?
yeah, give Marsha Lucas that money, you know? Mm-hmm. No, it's low budget. It's dirty. It's grimy. The fingerprints are all over the movie. Mm. And so it looks lived in and real and run down, and that's appealing. Oh. Yeah, I can watch Star Wars and like it as a... If you're asking me the best, here's the thing with this whole trilogy. If you ask me to talk about them in terms of Star Wars, none of them are going to hold a candle for me to Andor. Mm. Because in terms of this universe, this is the one that's actually engaging with the ideas that are brought up.
Yeah.
And A New Hope, Star Wars, is just stuffing your face with caramel corn. It's fluff.
It's your typical...
It's filler. It's way too bright and happy for about something this important, you know?
Yeah.
Not that, like, everything has to be taken seriously, but I'm just like, you're not engaging with the stuff you're bringing up. Mm. That said, as a 70s sci-fi... like B movie, an update of the 1930s serials. Wow, what a fun time! Mm. Like it hums along. It's a great little picture. It's got tons of characters that I like. Fun set pieces, fun little scene. It really does feel like it's 10-minute little set piece after set piece.
The editing clips along the story. It,
mm-hmm.
it feels tight.
It's and very clean. Efficient. And it doesn't really engage with the racism that is all over, against droids, against non-humans. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just a lot of stuff that, like, if we were to take that as analogous, would not be acceptable at all.
Talking about, like, how dirty Jawas are or something?
Yeah, and sand people, which are stereotypes, and Jawas are stereotypes, and the way people treat droids is like, oh, it's your indentured workforce because they're sentient. And the first thing we see Luke doing is buy one or two.
That have been captured to be for the purpose of being auctioned off.
Yeah, it's you didn't really think that one out.
And like, I guess, you know, I've been thinking this when I think you mentioned this in comparison to Star Trek. In terms of how it presents this,
sure, this, the inevitable comparison,
right? The inevitable
of wars to Trek,
of how it, you know, presents spacefaring people, and I feel like Star Wars is just so much more like fantasy in terms of where
it's also set in the past.
Well, yeah, and it, but like specifically where it has, like, I feel like it has its a lot of its connections is more of like fantasy stories about, like, you know, different races and
sure. Star and Wars has
magic
more,
yeah. And
Star Wars has more in common with Indiana Jones than with Star Trek.
Yeah, and Star Trek is like utopian future where everyone's included.
Yeah, even though,
or you know,
that's the idea.
The idea that it has had to improve upon as the times have changed.
Yes. Yeah, they really don't make movie scores like they used to.
Mm.
The score for Star Wars and the score for The Empire Strikes Back are two of the great scores. Like, I'd always been told that growing up, and I'd watch the movies, and I can hum all the tunes,
all 15 of the main themes or whatever. Mm. It's... they're so music forward. It's so... it feels so good to have music that good be that loud in the mix. Yeah. You know?
It's not subtle. It's not there to
just hide in there. It's huge and clear and simple. Mm. And I love it.
I love the shot, like the theme that I, you know, is very much the classic one that always hits me, is the one where Luke's staring at the twin sunset, and then sure, the music yeah. just swells, and yeah. it's just like, wow, we're just gonna pause and have that music just be here right now.
Yeah, John Williams is doing all the work in that scene.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, it would be a very different moment of Luke just silently staring at the suns. It's a very different movie. Simon Lang is directing that movie. But also filled with damp spaces. Anyway. it's Tatooine. But anyway.
We know what he's feeling
yeah,
in that moment. But and we John wouldn't Williams, otherwise.
Yeah. The level on which I responded to it most was on its level of its discussion of faith. Mm-hmm. The concept of the Force as, like, the Jedi as being a religious order. Mm-hmm. And that your father was a priest, mm-hmm. essentially, a Jedi Knight.
Yeah.
And so was I. And now that way is in exile. And I would like to teach you, pass on the teachings to you. Mm. And Han Solo and the people around him are like, what are you talking about? Mm. Use your technology, use your computer, use your blaster, like, you know, these things, use your guiding computer for to hit the shot in the Death Star. Mm. It's that arc of believe in something greater than yourself. Believing in Ben mm-hmm. and his teachings. The bit with Darth Vader and Ben fighting is cool. The climax with the Death Star at the end, I felt actually very little about. It was just kind of action climax.
I think I would have felt more if I was seeing that kind of action climax for the first time.
Yeah. But now we've seen a bajillion of those, and so it's, even though it's one of the first to do it like that, and it's great.
My eyes glaze over in kind of in any yeah. any scene like that, so mm-hmm. it's not like picking on it or anything.
Yeah. It's more interesting when it's personal.
Yeah.
When it's Ben versus Vader. Mm. And they're talking about ideas, yeah. about philosophy. No, don't bite my nipple. Okay, I'm going to go put her in the pen. Yeah. You talk about Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me what really, I don't know, held it together and like connected it for me was just Mark Hamill's face.
He's such a dweeb in this movie.
Yeah, but he's got, you know, this young, I'm thinking puppyish, of course, because I'm looking
we're
at one.
We're very experienced with puppies these days.
But he is very puppyish. He's, like, very, you know, quick to speak his mind and wants to go and do things and doesn't really...
He'll pout.
He doesn't really, you know his way around the world yet. He isn't jaded yet. And he's excited to be here. He's very happy to be here. And that makes me happy to be here. he is awestruck by the world, and he brings that to the audience, I think. That wonder. Which really makes it work for me because the story is so simple, it needs that, like, emotional...
It's a good adventure movie. I don't think it's a good war movie.
Yes.
That's that I finally figured out how to say it. Mm. It's a good adventure. It's a bad war movie because it doesn't engage with war.
Yeah. It's a good fantasy.
Yeah. And I think I'd kind of say the same with Empire.
Mm.
It engages it a little bit more. Mm. Empire is such a better movie.
Oh, yes.
Empire's great.
Yeah, like, I love Star Wars, but Empire's where it's at.
Yeah. Because in that movie, they're losing the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with them losing a battle. Like a big battle that they know they're not going to win.
Mm.
They're just hoping to be able to fight long enough so that they can escape.
This is a movie about them getting from one stance of where they're losing.
One hideout to another. Yeah.
That's the movie, is from getting point A to point B without dying.
Yeah. And on the way, they have various adventures. And Luke has a lot more discussions about faith with Yoda, who is an amazing character. He's so funny. And Han Solo and Leia. Okay, Han Solo and Leia have an interesting dynamic in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think you said it best when we were talking. Is that, how'd you put it? Like, if you know that she likes him?
If we know that she likes him, it's fine and it works and it's banter. If we don't know that she likes him, it looks like he's just, like, pressuring her.
Not taking no for an answer.
And being a creep.
Yeah.
And so when she...
When they finally kiss, it's like, wait, she was into him?
Right. And so, like, I don't remember seeing this movie for the first time. Mm-hmm. And so I've never seen it not knowing that she likes him back. And so, like, knowing that she likes him, I can go into it and be like, okay, it's fine, she likes him.
And there's a little moment, which your mom pointed out, which is when they're arguing and then he leaves and then she goes after to continue the argument because she's invested.
Yeah.
Fair. But also maybe she's just being petty. Like,
yeah, it doesn't equate to romantic
interest.
But once we both know that it's mutual and they like each other, the banter is fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I like where this film goes with discussions with continuing that journey of faith. It's pretty generic, as was the case with the first one, in terms of, you know, fear, hate, anger, bad.
Hmm.
You compared it to Buddhism, which I hadn't picked up on.
Yeah, and I'd I don't remember where I heard it, but I heard a comment on, like, it's one of those chains that we read about, where it's fear leads to anger leads to hate, or whatever, that being one of the talking points.
Yeah.
And how, like, I heard someone say that that's, like, misinterpreted, and I want to hear more, because, like, I don't even remember where I heard that.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah, the philosophy is very simple.
Mm.
I mean, it's four quadrant 1980 to the masses. River, you're fine. but the movie's core is the climax between Luke and Vader.
Mm.
Like, who even cares about he's his dad or whatever?
Mm.
It's just a beautiful scene. It's shot gorgeously.
Mm-hmm.
It's edited perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
The effects and the performances by James Earl Jones and Mark Hamill are great. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just a beautiful action through character through action climax.
Mm-hmm.
And then he falls, and he calls to Leia, and the music.
And he calls to Ben first.
Ben first. And it's part of this disillusionment. Mm-hmm. The moment that stood out to me the most in this movie, I mentioned to you, was because, you know, I've seen, even though I haven't watched these movies in 10 to 12 years, I've still seen clips my entire life because it's Star Wars and I live on the internet and specifically among film journalism. So of course I see these clips all the time. But the one that I hadn't seen is, why didn't Ben tell me he was my father? Why didn't Ben tell me? Like, his shock and disbelief and disillusionment in that moment is so beautiful. And again, the score in this movie is just huge and beautiful. And Han and Leia's theme, I mean, I was singing it for days after. Like, and that's the thing about John Williams, is he can just, his score for these movies, is you can just sing the score for a while because each theme flows so beautifully into the next. It's a great adventure movie. Again, I wouldn't call it a great war movie, but I think it's got a better mindset to start with, in that it's about survival, not... War isn't about triumph. It's about survival and protection of the things we care about.
And one thing that I thought was interesting for this movie is that there's, you know, this central struggle for Luke over, like, can he, you know, become a Jedi, or, like, will he lose his path? You know, and so he's kind of in the middle of these... you know, these competing ideologies, or, I don't know, you know, these two ends of the moral spectrum. And he knows what side he wants to be on. He wants to be a Jedi. But he comes to this point in the movie where he is told that it is the right thing for him to stay and study, and it is the Jedi thing for him to stay and study with Yoda.
He's presented with ultimatum, with a binary, with a dichotomy.
Yeah, and he's, you know, told not to get too attached and not to let his feelings control him, and that
he's told multiple times by Yoda, is like, if you care for your friends, you'll protect your interests, their interest and what they care about, by staying here and training, even if it means that they die.
And so he's given the ultimatum of, like, do the, quote, right thing and stay and become a Jedi, or go try to save your friends right now. And he doesn't choose the right thing. He chooses to save his friends. And that's, like, coupled also with his discovery that his father is not some Jedi, but Darth Vader. Mm-hmm. And this, you know,
his
greater...
His dad isn't dead. His dad is a fascist warrior, essentially.
Yeah. And so he's confronted with that connection and this, you know, changing sense of self. You know, and that larger disillusionment. And so I like that he's kind of in the middle, and his choices kind of place him in the middle, as not being the perfect Jedi, you know.
Yeah.
I love that tension for this movie.
Yeah, and it flows quite nicely into the next one, where he is a Jedi in all black, you know, who's very cocky, you know, like his father, but we haven't gotten to the prequels yet. I'm actually interested in watching them, not just because I haven't seen Revenge of the Sith or the other two movies in 10 years, but because I'm interested to see in how they function as war pictures.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's in the title. It's Star Wars. How do they function as war movies? And these films, not so much, you know? Return of the Jedi is, again, about triumph. It is about the end of the thing, which I guess World War II did end, but anyway... I'm getting ahead of myself. He is cocky. He is wearing all black, which that's not what Jedis do. They're in brown robes, you know, they're the light colored brown robes. And he's, what am I trying to say here? He deals in absolutes. Sorry, I'm borrowing from the prequels.
Yeah, and we're not there yet.
We're not there yet. But I know the line, only a Sith deals in absolutes. And he does that all the time. And so did Obi-Wan and Yoda in the last movie. Oh, yeah. It's kind of about the hypocrisy in all of this. And while he respects Yoda more than he respects, you know, the Emperor, that the whole system is kind of not great. And at the end, everyone's dead but him. Mm. And it's a very interesting journey. And it's so it's so wild to me that this guy was the puppy dog.
Yes. I love his character arc between just these three movies. Just such a transformation. In this one, he's so calm and collected, and he has an idea of what he wants, and mm-hmm. he doesn't get upset too easily, and he can stand very still, you know, next to Vader in that one, in the elevator or whatever.
Yeah.
And
his face looks different, not just because of a car accident, but because of his performance. He's not slack-jawed anymore. He's not doe-eyed anymore. His jaw is tight. His eyes are steely. His hair is kempt.
Yes. And he still is holding my interest in this movie, because, like, there's two main plots. There's his story and his confrontation with Vader and the mm-hmm. Emperor, and then there's his friends,
everybody else,
and their fight on
and their war
on Endor, the actual fight.
And I gotta be honest, everything that isn't Luke in this movie, kind of bored by.
I enjoyed it because, like, I didn't remember this movie too well, and
I didn't find it interesting.
Yeah, I enjoyed seeing it, but it was
watchable.
Yeah, I mean, I like the actors, and it was kind of like, yep, these people are fighting. But Luke's storyline was where it was at.
Yeah, the bang, bang, clash, clash, Ewok, Ewok, ub, nub. Yeah, your mom hates the Ewoks.
Yes.
You have a problem with the Ewoks.
Yes, I like the Ewoks. I think they're cute. I do enjoy teddy bears with spears like that.
Yes.
That is
and delightful. And gliders.
Yes. I am in favor of the Ewoks, but I don't think they work in the story.
How do you mean?
Or
as metaphor?
Yeah. You talked about how how Star Wars was
a metaphor for Vietnam.
Yes.
And the rebels were the Viet Cong, and the Empire was the United States of America.
Yes.
Not just Nazis, not just Mussolini. Mm. It was the United States, was the war machine, was the Death Star.
Yeah.
And then in Return of the Jedi, he makes that more explicit with the Ewoks and their guerrilla warfare being very much like the Viet Cong in the 70s. In the American War in Vietnam. And again, the Empire is America, who is not equipped to be there and don't do very well. They get one rock to the head and they drop, those stormtroopers.
Yeah, my issue with that is that they take, you know, these people who are meant to sympathize with. We're supposed to sympathize with the rebellion. We're supposed to care about these people and their struggle against the Empire. Mm-hmm. And they take all of that struggle that is, you know, analogous to this, you know, real world
conflict,
and they reduce it to teddy bears with spears.
Yeah.
And that's
it infantilizes them.
Right. They could have made any other group the Ewoks, but they chose to make them the Viet Cong.
Yeah.
And I think it doesn't. They're cute and they're fun and they.
It infantilizes and it primitivizes.
Yes. And especially with, like, the way they're treated in terms of, like, they don't speak the language.
They treat C-3PO as a god.
They are called primitive. And it's like, oh, their dialect is primitive.
Yeah.
When that would just be, like, their language.
Yeah.
How do you have better or worse language? It's just language.
Yeah.
It's all a whole bunch of stereotypes.
Yes, I agree.
And I don't, and if you want us to, you know, to sympathize with these people, like, stereotyping and infantilizing is maybe not the, yeah. the way to
Again,
go.
Again, cute in the abstract.
Yes.
Yeah, I just, yeah, everything with the battle, it's just more fighting, and we do it because it's right, and they're the bad guys, and we'll fight to the last person. We gotta take out as many as we can, even if we're gonna lose, even if we're doomed to fail. And the Death Star is even more blow-upable than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the only thing with any weight in this movie to me is that throne room.
Yeah. And I will watch it for that throne room.
And also the movie doesn't look as good. Like, no. it's not as interesting to look at until we get to that throne room where I found the film to actually be quite dark and like difficult to see.
Mm.
Like, I don't think that's just the transfer. Like, the other transfers were quite good. Like, it was physically hard to make things out. It wasn't lit as well. Everything was just kind of dark and dingy. Like, I remember in Dagobah, we could see everything fine.
Yeah.
In Empire.
And that's a very darkly colored movie.
Yeah, and there's a lot of darkness. It uses it well. It uses the shadows deliberately, where here it feels like everything's in shadow. Until we get to the throne room scene, in which everything is so dark that we have to use, in very deliberate lighting to make an interesting composition. And there it works. And there we have the green and the red lightsabers to make it interesting to look at. Anyway, but just like until we get there, it feels like this movie has almost no like meat on its bones.
Mm.
It's just more, you know? We haven't even mentioned Jabba's Palace and that whole bit.
Tell me about Jabba's Palace.
Well, it's all padding.
Mm.
What lessons does anyone learn there?
Yeah.
It felt like it was just an excuse to have that set piece, you know? Also, the visual effects aren't that great, I feel. Like, the practical ones are great, but, like, the digital effects in Jedi, I feel, are much less so than in the previous films. Anyway. Yeah, I don't like the depiction of Jabba. It just doesn't feel like it could be not offensive.
Yep.
In some way.
good way of putting it.
It's certainly a choice to put Carrie Fisher in that outfit. It feels pointless and demeaning.
Yeah. Well put.
I don't know. So yeah, Jedi is a mixed bag.
Mm.
I like the character, where the character of Luke goes, and it sets it up perfectly for The Last Jedi, which is a great movie.
Yeah.
And of course Luke would be jaded 30 years after this. Literally everyone who he was in this way with was dead, and everything that Obi-Wan and Yoda and Vader and the Emperor told him, all of them were wrong on some level.
Mm.
Of course this all has to die.
And he underwent such great character development over three films with an unlimited span of time.
Yeah, over four or five years. 30 years, yeah, he's going to have changed a bit.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was very fun watching these movies.
Oh, yeah.
Also, the score isn't as good in Return of the Jedi. It's not nearly as prominent.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was very fun watching these movies with your mom. And Atticus.
Oh. And we had him on the couch with us.
Yeah,
just
we have,
like,
so which,
another
we,
person.
We have Atticus, an Akita lab, who's huge.
Gigantic.
Next to River, who's tiny.
Oh.
And then we had Mystique, the cat. And all six of us were on the couch.
For one moment.
For about 30 seconds, we had everyone on the couch together. And it was amazing as we started Return of the Jedi. Yeah,
it's fun. Mom does not like Atticus on furniture, but B does like Atticus on furniture. So
yes.
Whenever
whenever he comes over.
He just awkwardly, like, is encouraged to get up on the couch, and she's like, all right, come on.
Or onto the bed or something.
Come on, and he's like, okay.
And so at one point, I just pick Atticus up, which is no small task.
He is a person-sized dog.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Fun times. We still haven't talked about Poirot.
Mm-hmm.
All the Poirot movies we watched. Mm-hmm. We still haven't talked about Get Back.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to do those real quick?
Sure.
Okay. This is not the order in which we watched them. We watched the first episode of Get Back.
Mm-hmm.
Part one. Really fun.
Yeah.
Watching the Beatles jam for 3 hours. They play the bit from The Thin Man. We get to see them start to write Let It
Third
Be.
Man.
Oh, sorry. Third Man, not Thin Man. Yeah. Thank you. I find myself almost mixing them up all the time, and then I just did that. Anyway.
There is the third Thin Man, but that's...
Yes, that's but that's not... That. That's yeah, not nearly as good a movie as The Third Man or The Thin Man. get to see them start to write Let It Be and Get Back... And I've Got a Feeling, and just, and Two of Us, like, so many just amazing, but we get to see them, like, mess around with trying to figure out the song work, and so we hear different arrangements, and they're good. Mm. Like, it's just, it's delight.
It, you know, all those...
And you're a bigger, longer Beatles fan than I am, so this must be different, this must be cool for you.
This is pretty cool. Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know all those, like... biopics that are like try to recreate the cool moments that got us all our favorite jams, you know?
Yeah.
This is just the moment.
The actual moment. Yeah. Where we get to watch Paul McCartney messing around on a guitar until he has Get Back written.
Yeah.
Like, and we get to see them try to spin it as a protest song, which is really cool.
Oh, that was cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love seeing, like, it lays out the, like, the calendar dates, which I thought was really helpful. I'm a very big timeline person. I love seeing, okay,
have
this...
you started work on your calendar yet?
No.
Honey.
I know. But to be able to see, okay, like, go day by day, here's their deadline, here's where they are. I love having that laid out so clearly.
Yeah. So, all right. Good times. Mm. Murder on the Orient Express. Mm. You'd seen it before. I'd seen it before.
Which one?
The Brana.
Yes.
You didn't really like it.
I didn't like it the first time.
The first time. I thought it was fine the first time. I saw it on a plane.
Hmm.
We rewatched it. Great first act.
Oh, yeah.
Brana knows how to open this movie. He knows how to set everything up. And then you fell asleep to it.
I did.
I mean, you were intending to.
Because I had seen it before and I had to work.
Yeah, you need to work in the morning.
I will say, yeah, this time around, like, I wasn't expecting it to be very good because I didn't have, like, a very positive memory of it. And then I was watching and I was like, hey, I'm quite enjoying this. And then I fell asleep.
Yeah. And I can say that Brana way oversells this. I don't like the way that this movie resolves. There's too much action. It's way too melodramatic at the end, and the mystery isn't presented well enough so that there's much weight at the end. It just feels like the mystery was contrived to get that reveal, the solution, which I won't give away just in case you don't know. Read the book. It's great. We watched the Lumet version. I don't like Perrault. In Lumet's version. I think Albert Finney is grating and annoying.
Yep.
He grows on me simply just because I get used to him. I never like him. I just get used to him. It would be fun to hang out with Brana's Perrault for a while. Eventually he'd get annoying.
He's so wholesome, though.
He'd probably accuse you of murder at least once.
Mm.
But he would treat you to a lovely dinner.
Mm.
Finney scares me.
Yeah, and like, just an example that you brought up was, like, how Brana talks about a sex worker.
Yes, he's very, yeah, he is respectful of everybody.
Yeah. He brings up the fact that she's a sex worker so he can show off the fact that he can show his intelligence.
Yes.
And to talk to people, you're a sex worker, you know.
Yes, and you're a sex worker. She is. I am charmed. Like, yeah. It's...
and that just so wholesome. Whereas, like, with Finny, there's, like, one moment where he's making ogling. Comments about, I forget.
The Countess.
The Countess. He's ogling the Countess.
Oh, if, like, I were a younger man.
And I'm like, keep away from me, please.
The Poirot stuff in the Lumet version, not as interesting. But the mystery is so much better set up and pays off so much better in that it doesn't need action. It just needs people talking in rooms. And then at the end, you get to let Albert Finney talk for 15 minutes straight.
And I like him more when he's doing his thing, talking 15 minutes straight.
Because he's doing his job. He's doing his job well, and we can always appreciate a guy doing his job well.
It feels like he's a strange man who's got one thing he can do really well.
And this is that moment.
Time for him to shine.
Yeah, and as he puts the mystery together, it's lovely.
Mm.
And it feels like the payoff to the wind-up that this whole movie has been. Whereas in the Brana version, I felt that it was more like a reveal to a bunch of different facts that I didn't really think connected.
This one feels much better structured.
Yeah.
Much tighter.
I like this. I like this version much more, the Lumet version. Mm. It has a very different tone with its ending than the Brana version. The Brana version ends quite melancholically. It's like, this is the solution. I guess you can just live with that. And then at the end of the Lumet version is like, this is the solution. Ta-da-da-da-da! Taps the side of his nose and everybody goes, hey!
Yeah.
Like, okay.
I kind of like that one.
You like it?
I think it worked for me.
It did not work for me. It was just kind of surprising. But for Brana, it's a part of his arc, as we eventually see. You didn't see Death on the Nile, but I did. At the beginning of Murder on the Orient Express, there is right and there is wrong and there is no in between.
Mm.
And at the end of Murder on the Orient Express, he's lost. He's been disillusioned.
I like that as an arc.
Yeah. And the ending of the movie is silent and just like, I guess I don't know.
Mm.
And... And then at the beginning of the Death on the Nile, he is in that. He's a bit wearier. Time has gone by and he's seen a lot of things and he's not totally sure of himself anymore. After a double opening of a flashback to World War I, which gives the origin of the mustache...
Didn't know a mustache needed an origin story, but
that mustache does. And then this incredibly sexy opening at a bar with, like, okay, the cast of Death on the Nile is problematic. It has Armie Hammer and Letitia Wright and Gal Gadot and Russell Brand, but anyway, three sex pests and a Zionist walk into a bar. No, two sex pests, a Zionist, and an anti-vaxxer walk into a bar. Literally. Anyway, but just these very stylish, interesting openings. And then the movie is death until we get to the actual literal death in the movie. And then the mystery goes on and it's fine. And I actually think that it's a better whole than Murder on the Orient Express. I find it to be more satisfying in terms of the mystery. And the character arc is such that Death on the Nile is quite a dark film by the end. People die in that movie. Like, a lot of people die in that movie. And at the end, Brana Poirot is just, I'm done with this. The murder, the death is no longer fun. You know? Like, it's, I can't get anything out of this. It's just pain. Which leads us, and that's an interesting ending. And at the end of the movie, he shaves his mustache you know, and is sitting in that same bar again, but now it's empty and he's alone and his face is bare and we can see the scar, you know, like symbolic. Mm. It's an interesting ending.
Yeah.
Which brings us to A Haunting in Venice, which we did watch together all the way through. And boy, what a delight.
It's so fun. It just feels like a spooky good time. You know, it's like I am in the mood for something spooky. And then you just put on this and it's like, yep. It hits the spot.
Mm-hmm. Spooky good time. Brana is throwing the camera around every which way. It's
the upside down shot, though.
The upside down shot. The Dutch angles are back in full force.
He is having a good time.
Yes. Having a lovely time directing this. Mm-hmm. We're actually on a location. It's not just a bunch of CGI around a train and CGI around a boat. We're now just in a building and he can shoot it fun. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much about the cast of characters as it is about Poirot, this movie. Mm-hmm. It is about him as a character and what he believes. Again, we get back to faith in this movie. This is a man who has seen so much violence over the course of two world wars. This is a post-World War II movie, and it is very much a post-World War II movie. Mm. Pretty much every character is dealing with some effects of the war in some way, and that's cool. But a war picture than Star Wars, eh? And it's about trauma and about grief and about, can you find meaning in this world? You know? And I found that intensely interesting. And the murder mystery is also there, and it's fine, and it's fun. But what I'm here for is the character who, is he going mad? Is he having a come to Jesus moment? Is he having a come to Satan moment? Yeah. it's really fun.
Yeah, and I love part of the mystery being, is it real? Mm-hmm. Like, there's the mystery of whodunit, and then there's the mystery of,
is Poirot actually seeing ghosts?
Yeah. And I like that there's just some ambiguity there.
Mm-hmm. There's some.
There's not too much, but
yeah.
But enough.
Just enough for him to get a little bit of faith back and to go back to his gig.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a very satisfying film.
Yeah.
Huntington Bass. Not great, but very fun.
Oh, a solid picture.
Solid picture.
I'm gonna drink some milk and go to sleep.
But I forgot. Hmm? I also put together little short films.
Oh yeah.
Little Lego stop motion short films from my childhood. My dad found our SD cards from my childhood of little stop motion clone guy and stuff, and you can go watch those short films on YouTube. They're up.
Very fun.
Yeah.
Very fun, very cute. Very, very good for a 9-year-old.
Thank you.
I was very impressed.
Yeah. I have a very soft spot for the clone guy shorts that I made with my friends Jacob and Abby. We just had this clone guy minifigure. That's what we called him. This, you know, clone trooper. And just the shtick would be is that a guy would come up to him, pull a gun on him, and then he would pull from behind his back a ginormous gun and then blow the guy up. And that was the whole bit. And the gun would just keep getting bigger and bigger that he was pulling from behind his back. And then we'd play on that joke. And we didn't find, not all of them are here. I remember specifically we made one where a gun, where he pulled out a tiny gun, the other guy laughed, and then the gun grew. Yeah. Like, it built up and then blew him up. But just, anyway, like, so they're not all there. But they're there, and I thought they were all lost. And so this is a film, a lost film has been found.
Yeah.
13 lost films have been found. And
restored.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, 10 of them are up on YouTube to watch. I'll link to them in the description of the podcast. Okay, but can we talk about the comic timing in the golf one, though?
It's so good.
It's very strange.
There's
like who would come up with that? Apparently me? Apparently I thought that was funny.
The Wampa glitches. I don't want to explain that. Wampa glitches. Like, bizarre.